Hi everyone. I'm not sure if this is recording, but it's Naomi Wolf. Hey everyone. Hi everyone. It's Naomi Wolf, and as I promised, this is the second part of 10 Steps to Fascism, Step 10. Unfortunately, many of you have asked me to apply the map that I spelled out in my book, The End of America, which foretold really everything we're seeing currently in the United States and worldwide. Many of you have asked me to update the lessons of that book for the current moment, because it's obvious that some form of degradation of democracy is underway in the United States and worldwide. So that's what I'm doing. And many of you saw the first episode, which was part one of this three-part series. This is the second episode, and then I'll do a final episode, and you will know everything I know by the end of that time about what to expect in the weeks and months ahead based on what history shows closing democracies always look like. To restate the thesis of the end of America, every would-be tyrant on the left or on the right always takes the same 10 steps, always uses the same playbook. It always works to close an open society and to suppress a democracy. So unfortunately, when I say I do this with a heavy heart, it's because everything I predicted came true, and it's easy to know what the weeks and heads will the weeks and months ahead will look like if we do not take steps to resist them. So this second section is about how we got here, and I want to stress that the playbook of fascism is not partisan, and President Trump did not invent what we're living through now. He merely built upon it. So a lot of people on the left don't want to hear this, but during the administration of President Obama, I and several others warned that Democrats were taking the authoritarian structures built up by George W. Bush and adding levels of oppression on the foundation that was already laid. So President Obama was the one who took the unprecedented step of droning to death an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, and his teenage son in Yemen, which had never happened before. It was Obama who promised to close Guantanamo as part of his campaign agenda and then built it up a mere 6 months later in an expansion that I witnessed as a journalist. It was Obama whose lawyers argued for the right to imprison journalist Chris Hedges without charge or trial, and by extension, all journalists or any American citizen under the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which was and is a shocking piece of legislation that allows the president to detain anyone indefinitely without charge or trial. It was Obama who presided over the violent, coordinated 2011 crackdown by the Department of Homeland Security against Occupy Wall Street, which could have been a dress rehearsal for today's even more escalated violence against protesters. And I just want to note, in the last update about this, I shared that this is so nonpartisan and that the left and the right are both using the tools of fascism right now, and that the violence of protesters always creates an easier access to fascism and always plays into the hands of those who are trying to kill democracy. So the war on whistleblowers intensified under President Obama's Department of Justice. He prosecuted reporters such as the New York Times' James Risen. He advanced the prosecution of Chelsea Manning. President Obama went after more people under the Espionage Act than had any previous president, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Examples of his push to build up further the structures of fascism that he had inherited from George W. Bush could go on and on. But since he was a telegenic Democrat with an uplifting rhetorical style, not to mention the otherwise inspiring fact that he was our first president of color, these abuses of democratic processes went disregarded by the left and by most mainstream media. And I am really going to say the chickens have come home to roost. This is karma. I mean, I'm not saying the left did it, but the left didn't object when the next level of the fascist monument was built up by our guy. So the problem with fascistic processes and institutions being built up is that then they're there for the next president, the one you don't like, the one you didn't vote for, to use and to abuse. And so here we are. So obviously we are in an endgame, a catastrophic slide to lasting authoritarianism, again, unless we stop it. So I'm going to always say, you know, there is hope, but it's up to us. And then at a certain point, as I said last time and always, at a certain point there isn't hope. I'm just going to be honest with you. There isn't hope without bloody civil war, other forms of violence. We have very little time before we reach a point of no return. As I've often pointed out, democracies don't close arithmetically, but geometrically. That is, there is a slow slide during which citizens can indeed turn events in another direction using democracy itself. But then in the playbook of fascism, there will be a sudden coordinated shock after which no return is possible. History shows it's extraordinarily difficult for a nation or a people to retrieve a collapsed democratic civil society that recently had a rule of law once it's gone. Even then, bloodshed, arrests, suppression, and anguish are the future, often for years or for generations. So in the interest of avoiding that at all costs, I'm saying what the playbook holds, so we might avoid that desperate future still. And in the last section of these three talks, I'll explain how the very real coronavirus crisis is being used to move things more rapidly along. So obviously, President Trump is familiar with fascism's playbook and has moved briskly to execute it in 3 years. He's not, as the left likes to state, a terrible president. He is a terrible president in a democratic context, but he is a fantastically effective president at turning democracy into a tyranny. And he has moved with tremendous skill, speed, and strategy to put in place all the elements of a totalitarian society. And by the way, I use the terms fascist and totalitarian interchangeably to stress how much the authoritarian execution of right and left are identical in techniques and outcomes, though they differ in symbolism. At the same time that President Trump is moving swiftly through fascism's traditional playbook, the left is also seeking, as I said, authoritarian control, if less efficiently, in ways that really mirror what President Trump is doing. So President Trump did not have to, quote, invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy, which is step one of the 10 steps. When he took office, ISIS was the real and terrifying threat that was also invoked to justify the erasure of our liberties. But since March 2020, the COVID pandemic has served in that useful role for both left and right, and as you may have noticed, has totally eclipsed ISIS fears. We don't read about ISIS anymore. What happened to them? Who knows? They are no longer under every bed. It's not to say they didn't exist or they are not real, a point that is often taken out of context by critics who are trying to undermine what I'm trying to tell you. But it does mean that you should notice that ISIS was such a scary, scary, scary looming threat. And now that the coronavirus is the perfect cover for authoritarianism, as we'll see, we really don't hear about ISIS because its role isn't as significant for retaining power. Neither Trump nor Biden needs to create secret violent prisons, which is step two, as Guantanamo is still open. But Trump has turned ICE into a steward of prisons without accountability, which even members of Congress cannot enter. And he often showcases that members of Congress aren't allowed in to check on children or to enter facilities. He's made a spectacle of separating families, losing children, leaving people in real photo ops to sleep on hard floors with tinfoil blankets, none of which would pass International Red Cross inspection. Bill Moyers noted that agents of Customs and Border Patrol wearing military uniforms were deployed violently to constrain protests in Portland and in Chicago. Quote, Trump is turning the officers of the executive branch into the president's private army, he said. So again, that's typical of step two in a closing democracy. The would-be tyrant uses secret police and uses militias who are not answerable to the people. This militarization of domestic police forces and the brutality of incarceration, which started under George W. Bush but also escalated under Obama, means that the violent arrest and unaccountable prison experience is no longer offshore in Guantanamo, it's come to our own shores. So step three involves the use of militias. Now that you have them, you use them. I'm just grabbing my water. President Trump has spoken positively of violence and tweeted others threats of, quote, civil war. Indeed, at a 2017 rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, a white nationalist killed a woman and injured 35 other people, and President Trump famously spoke of very fine people on both sides. And Mehdi Hassan of The Intercept lists some more of President Trump's invitations to violence. Quote, if you see someone getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Parenthesis, crowd cheers. I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you. Maybe he should have been roughed up because it was absolutely disgusting what he was doing. Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it. This is the President of the United States. After armed neo-fascist groups stormed state capitals to protest the lockdown, the, quote, anti-government militia group Oath Keepers openly threatened any police officers who enforce stay-at-home orders or try and prevent anti-lockdown rallies. The president praised as, quote, responsible people and very good people, these militias. Okay, so again, it's building up unaccountable militias and issuing threats of violence. Hassan warns, is this a preview of what's going to happen in November? Are these right-wing militias, these domestic terrorists, with their guns and their masks and their combat gear and with the encouragement not just of Alex Jones types on InfoWars or Judge Jeanine's on Fox News, but also with the encouragement of the man in the White House, will they take to the streets to dispute the presidential election results? Will they riot on behalf of a defeated Trump? This is not a theoretical question. If you know the 10 steps to fascism, what would-be dictators always do, you can count on it. You can expect that militias that are sympathetic to President Trump, that has that have connections to President Trump, will riot. And to be even-handed, on the Democratic side, you see this escalation of violence. You don't see Democratic leaders telling violent protesters to stand down and calm down. That, too, is a way of escalating violence to grab power, to intimidate the other side. Both sides are doing it. The left-wing Antifa movement is also extraordinarily violent for an American protest movement, as I just noted. So these violent militias, replete with confirmed infiltrators and provocateurs, exist now on both sides of the political divide. But this bilateral violence is good for would-be tyrants. They like it. In a closing society, instability and provocation are both useful to autocrats. We get scared. We don't join protest. We stay home. In a closing society, this is an excuse for the declaration of a state of emergency and consequent suspension of the rule of law, which is the goal of a would-be dictator on the left or on the right. Step four is to set up an internal surveillance system. The COVID pandemic allows for this with track and trace, a development that we will address in the essay after this one. But a surveillance system is being set up. The contracts are being handed out. Your DNA is being taken by Google every time you get a coronavirus test. If you go to Rite Aid, I've documented this, and that data is being sold. It violates or bypasses HIPAA law. And so a social map is being created. McKinsey has one of the contracts, so that you, not only where you're going, but where your family is going, where your friends are going, who has relationships with whom, that's all being tracked. Step five is to infiltrate and harass citizens' groups. It's really not necessary any longer, as people gathering in groups has been broken apart by coronavirus policies. The COVID-19 lockdown has basically suspended citizens' groups. People can wear masks briefly to gather and protest, but the ban on gathering of groups of more than 6 or more than 10, depending on where you are, pretty much takes care of any effective confidential citizen activism. So lockdown is incredibly useful in Australia, in Britain, in Spain, in the United States, in Canada, for doing away with democracy, because people gathering to protest is one of the most powerful ways to create change. And now that's been effectively undone as a useful way for people to convene and disrupt business as usual. It's not allowed in some cases in Australia, which I always see these days as a petri dish for policies that are being tested and then exported in advanced democracies to close them down. People are getting tickets from police if they're out for more than an hour of exercise every day. Buildings full of people are being held inside at gunpoint by police. They're being held by police inside. I'm not sure what level of weapons are involved, but I know that they're being detained effectively inside their own homes, though they're innocent, and coronavirus is the excuse. Step six is to engage in arbitrary detention and release. And in Portland, Oregon, quote, personal accounts and multiple videos posted online show officers driving up to people, detaining individuals with no explanation about why they're being arrested and driving off. And as I said in The End of America, when you want to close an open society, you don't detain, arrest, and process people with normal judicial processes. You detain them, scare the hell out of them, and let them go. Detain them, scare them, let them go. Hitler did this, Mussolini did this, Stalin did it, Pinochet did it. It's done in China. Every closing society has arbitrary detention and release. Step seven is to target key individuals. And again, this step is really less necessary with the coronavirus pandemic, because think about how coronavirus restrictions are working now. They're keeping new leaders from arising to move populations. And they're really keeping new ideas from circulating in face-to-face private communications to activate groups in a sustained way. Everything's online, which means everything is subject to surveillance. I don't think people really understand that. Who owns Zoom, right? Who owns TikTok? Who owns WhatsApp? I mean, everything you do that's not in a private face-to-face communication can be monitored. But established influencers on the left of center in the UK and US have been targeted by Cambridge Analytica type reputational attacks from the right for about a decade. And now the left is trying to do the same thing. These are multifaceted, and they include calls to workplaces, legal actions, bots and troll farm attacks, and other reputational assaults. I've been reading climate scientist Michael Mann's book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, which details such right-wing harassment and legal harassment and reputational attack on climate scientists. And Jane Mayer, the investigative reporter, describes similar targeting in her book, Dirty Money. And if you, talk to individual influencers like Marianne Williamson, who ran for president, she often speaks about how words were put in her mouth. She was made to sound loopy. She was marginalized by smear campaigns, essentially, over and over and over again. Influencers on the left experience these kinds of reputational attacks, and also on the right. So the Trump administration goes further and targets individuals in its own government. It targets those who serve in government oversight bodies. And I've cited an article about how he targets government watchdogs. He targets citizens who challenge him. He singled out a Twitter employee who dared to fact check a tweet of his. He targets individual reporters. He used Twitter to imply that TV host Joe Scarborough had murdered a congressional aide in 2001, which is false. But again, these singling out of individuals, Michael Mann calls it the Serengeti effect, where like lions separate an antelope from the herd and then tear it to pieces because it's isolated, it's vulnerable, it's worn out. The attacks are coming from all sides. So you're seeing that, and social media amplifies it. So fear of retribution for speech then, in the wake of these attacks, Chill's leadership and dissent in closing society. But again, the coronavirus crisis intensifies this weakening of democracy because new ideas and leaders are constrained from reaching audiences because we're all dependent on digital algorithms now. And if the lockdown lasts indefinitely and existing leaders are attacked and undermined, eventually the people will have no one to whom to turn when the final would-be shock takes place. So that's another reason that lockdown is very, very dangerous for democracy, right? Twitter can turn up or down the volume on any leader. Facebook can turn up or down the volume of any leader. And if we can't wander in the streets and encounter one another, or have meetings, or share information face-to-face, really, leaders can be manufactured and erased, and we're completely subject to what digital algorithms decide we should be able to hear or not hear. Step 8 is to control the press. President Trump has called the press an enemy of the people. This is really notably a Stalinist term, and it was used against Nikolai Bukharin in the 1938 show trial that led to his execution in the Soviet Union. So it's not what you want to be called if you're a reporter. President Trump, as we know, assails news outlets as fake news and attains control by such distortions of fact that the press can't do its traditional job effectively at all. And same is happening on the left. And so now readers in America and Britain, which until recently really had newspapers and journalism, can no longer tell truth from fiction. So this is a methodology. It was used by Soviet and now Russian propagandists. It's used by China to invalidate the news media. But it's a real goal of a totalitarian society to so confuse news consumers that finally they give up. They don't expect to be able to know what's true and what's not true. And we're just about there. Step 9 casts criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. President Trump has charged, quote, a dozen people and entities with treason, according to the Washington Post, though a total of 30 people has been charged with that capital crime in all of American history. So there's a lot of charges of treason flying around. He stated that the Democrats pursuing impeachment hearings should be charged with treason, for instance, and that they should be arrested. And step 10, of course, is to subvert the rule of law and replace it with martial or military law. So we are here. This is where we are. This is the last step, the end game of every bid for authoritarian power. And I will tell you in this series of essays just what we can expect for the next 2 months and 10 days and after that. And lastly, I will explain in my next video of this set of three videos how the coronavirus hastens this closing of democracy and helps the autocrats. So